Welcome to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Each episode will explore DIY bio, citizen science, and medical device security with guests from the healthcare, cybersecurity research, and biohacking communities. Hosted by Nina Alley and Bo Woods.
Hey, Nina.
Hi.
How are you?
Superb. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
You know, I was just reading about some interesting research on how some people are more prone to certain types of tumors than other people. Mm-hmm. They have genetic abnormalities that make them just more susceptible to certain types of tumors. Do you know anything about that? Have you read about that?
Yeah. So there are certain genetic anomalies that, because you don't have this certain gene code, that will make you more susceptible to different cancers. There are researchers, biocitizen researchers, to be more specific, that are working on them, and we're actually going to talk to one today.
Oh, great.
I know you're excited.
Yeah, I am.
So we're going to have...
Face. You can see it.
I know. You're so pink. So we're going to talk to Rich Lee today. Hey, Boo.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So we brought you in because you're working on some really incredible things right now. And like Bo started off this talk with, specifically with cancer-related items, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, so currently I'm working on NF2 mutations, which technically isn't a cancer, but NF2 is a gene that creates a tumor suppressant called Merlin in your cells. And so basically when there's a defect here, it leaves your cells vulnerable to mutation. So basically over time, you will develop tumors basically in your peripheral nerves, in your brain, and in your spine. It's pretty serious stuff. And even though these tumors are benign, they can still be very life threatening.
Yeah.
You know, because they still grow large and cut off blood flow to some areas. And in most NF2 patients, normally what happens is the first thing that happens is their auditory nerve begins to grow tumors and they lose their hearing. So that's usually the first thing to go.
So really quick, are you saying NFT, MFT, and what does it stand for?
So NF2.
Oh, sorry, okay. That's, what does it stand for?
Neurofiber, I'll have to look it up. It's a neurofibromatosis 2 or something like that.
Neurofibromatosis 2.
Yeah. Okay. And you know what? I am an amateur researcher. So, everything you're going to hear tonight is like just, you know, from my amateur research, just diving into the problem of NF2 deficiencies and mutations. So if I butcher words or whatever, then
it's part of the learning process. That's what we do. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up that you're an amateur researcher. Tell us more about who you are, because I love the problem you're working on. Tell us more about who you are and how this problem came to be something you're working on.
So, first off, I've been in biohacking since probably 2008. I was mostly doing device kind of stuff, but I've done a lot of different experiments like CRISPR and, I've been getting heavy into the bio side of things, for a while, recently. And, that's definitely not a strong suit, but I don't know. I've come a long way. So in the devices, I started, I was known for implanting, my own headphones. Mm-hmm. I was probably the first guy to do that in my ears. So that was in 2013.
So are you listening to us right now through your implanted headphones?
No, actually, I need another thing to hook it up to. And unfortunately, that's in a storage unit at the moment. So with the rest of my everything I own. So
you have these implanted headphones.
Yeah.
For congenital reasons, for funsies, because aesthetic.
You know what? A little bit. It's a little bit for funsies, but I do have this like eye condition, and it's correctable with like a cornea transplant. But you know that requires me to have money, and then also find a donor and all that. Yeah. So, but anyway, basically one day I had an eyeball that just kind of was blurry, wasn't working good. And I thought, oh, maybe it'll go away. And I went to the doctor, and he just said, look, you've got corneal degeneration, and it's permanent. Your other eye can go anytime. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, man, that's going to suck. Because, you know, at the time I was, married, and I have kids. And so, like, you know, I was trying to figure out how to take care of my family, you know, if I was blind, legally mm-hmm. blind. There'd just be like this time period where I'd have to like, you know, deal with life, I guess. And so I decided to be kind of proactive, and I wanted to like make this like echolocation device. And I didn't want it like disturbing people around me. So my idea was I was going to have like this like ultrasonic transmitter that nobody else could hear, making clicking noises, and then just have it go back to like some implanted headphones. And so basically I came up with this idea to implant these headphones and use this coil to transmit the audio through, and to basically work in conjunction with this echolocation device. So it didn't actually work out very well for the echolocation device, but I mean, it was still pretty cool. I got to do other cool experiments with it in sensory substitution and augmentation.
So you're basically then, like Daredevil now. You can hear what's going around you and fight crime with the stick. Yeah, Daredevil.
Daredevil, that one. Yeah. So are you Daredevil? Yeah. Do we get to call you that from now on? I feel like yes.
So, you know, that was the plan, but like, you know, it didn't quite work out, you know, with the implant. So it's kind of back to the drawing board for the echolocation thing, which I'll get to eventually. It's on my project list.
That's cool.
But yeah, so it, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of stupid, but like my headphone setup is mono, and I really need stereo to echolocate.
So from the projects you've just talked about, they seem to be a lot based on congenital issues. Does that feel right? And if they
yeah,
are,
I guess so. And you know,
why are you drawn
honestly,
that way?
Like, are you talking about the eye condition too, or just the NF2 stuff?
NF2, your ears, your eyes.
Okay, so my eyes. I'm not sure if the corneal degeneration.
No. But why are you drawn to those projects that seem to be more congenital issues? You know,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I guess I'm drawn to a lot of projects, and things, but like the ones that, you know, really light a fire under me are the ones that are real issues, you know, mm-hmm. or have an immediate practical application that I, you know, I think I can feasibly do or take on. So, I mean, you know, obviously with my eyesight, that's important to me because I suffer from that condition. So, you know, that was a easy, or I was motivated. How about that?
Yeah.
I was motivated to do it. So, and then, you know, with this NF2 thing, I don't actually have NF2 mutation, but I do know somebody who does. And she's a really good kid. And I think she's like 10 years old right now. Mm-hmm. And basically she's going to be facing deafness very soon. And then... you know, it'll just get progressively worse. She's got tumors on her spine that could get larger and cause paralysis in nerves, or in different limbs, I mean. Like a drooping of the face occurs.
So what's the current treatment for NF2? Do they just go in and, you know, remove the tumors if they can?
You know what? Because the tumors grow on these nerves that just, you know, branch throughout your body, you know, it's so hard. It's not, and these are benign tumors, so they're not metastasizing. They're not like growing out of control. They just sporadically pop up, and so in like little clusters on along the nerve. And so it's really hard for a doctor to go in, you know, on this nerve and like try to remove stuff. There is like a gamma knife thing that they try to do for, some kind of procedure that they try to do to remove the vestibular schwannomas, and that's mm-hmm. the thing basically in your ear that causes deafness eventually in NF2 patients. But you know that's very difficult to do. And because, you know, you're born with this mutation, it's like, you know, your healthy cells are going to, at some point, grow more tumors. And so it's going to be like an ongoing thing. And you're just kind of building up more and more tumors over time. It's really sad. And also like brain tumors.
So on with this, what you're looking for with this NF2 treatment, how does that help the future of cancer? Or cancer treatment, rather.
So it's interesting because like a lot of people are going after cancers, right? Like there's a lot of money behind cancers because those things are growing out of control. They'll take your life really fast, but a lot of people a lot of researchers kind of neglect the benign tumors because, you know, they seem, oh, they're benign. No, they're not life threatening immediately or they could be, but you know, I think the word benign just kind of like, you know, pacifies people, yes. You know, like, so I don't know. There's a lot of money behind cancer, but like attacking a benign tumor is a little bit trickier, and there's not a lot of people that are, there is research going into it, but it's not as much as like, you know, like a cancer. Yeah, like full-on cancer. So honestly, like a lot of these benign tumors have more in common with like moles on your mm-hmm. skin, right, than they do with cancers. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's like they metabolically and everything.
So essentially what you're doing is changing the... So in cancer, if it's something that it's an OMA or to stage zero, they usually do the watch and wait. Sorry, it's wait and watch. Criteria. So are you turning it into, it's a stage zero, it's a benign, but we can do this to make you more comfortable, or we can do this to take these benign tumors and just eradicate them?
Yeah, so basically I just tore the topic apart, and I was like, okay, what do we need to do to like fix the mutation permanently, you know, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't pop up? What do we need to do to basically address the symptoms of the tumors, or just like attack the tumors themselves as they occur? You know, what can we do to prevent maybe future tumors from forming? You know, like basically what are all the angles of attack? And then, so I just have kind of like methodically come up with a list of like about 13 different interventions, wow. you know, at this point that we want to try. And, you know, as a private researcher, it's, you know, I can involve friends and things like that in cell work, you know, mm-hmm. and we can look at stuff in a dish and you know, try to measure stuff there. But
so what does that hurdle mean for your research?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing I kind of started this thinking, okay, I got my list of interventions, like, you know, time to test it out. And so I just thought, I'll order these like genetically modified zebrafish and, you know, just make some tanks or whatever, and this will be easy. But now, you know, transporting a genetically modified animal is like against the rules.
So there's
four different overseeing bodies on this or something like that. Huh.
So what do you need to do? Do you have to like write a letter to them all and get, you know, the principal's note to start working on your zebrafish, or what does that process look like?
So like if you want to have an animal testing lab, and don't get me wrong, some of these regulations, they're legitimately, they got good legitimate reasons for doing things the way they do. But basically, there's certain rules for animal testing labs. Like you've got to have like, you know, a room that's like hermetically sealed basically from the outside world. You could have a window, but like it's like you've got to have one separate room where you keep the dead bodies of the animals. You have to have this like special disposal process. If you're dealing with fish and you've got like, if you've got like a fish tank full of like chemicals, because, you know, you're feeding this fish drugs, you know, then those chemicals, you know, have to be disposed of in the wastewater. You've got to do like, there's a lot of things that are basically like best practices that you know, everyone should follow. But like, as far as legally, you know, getting certified, you know, you got to have a lab, and then you have to form a committee of like, I think it's like 5 or 7 people. I forget. Like, you have to like form an independent committee to like review, you know,
you need each an IRB. Your project. So institutional review board.
It's like, it's kind of the equivalent of an IRB, where it's like, wow, you know, we're going to, it's going to get reviewed by a board, and like the board's going to decide if it's worth
researching.
Worth a lot. Yeah.
Huh. So I don't know if either one of you know this, but there was conversation about getting a citizen scientist biohacking IRB group together and modeling it after traditional IRBs in hospitals and institutions like that. Do either of you have any thoughts on that? Good, bad, or indifferent?
I think that's awesome. Like, I think to validate, though, well, you need to like animal validation before you go to the IRB.
Mm.
You know, so it's like, I think that's awesome. I think if I remember right, though, I think like IRBs are like, project dependent. Like, I think you need a different IRB for every trial you're doing.
That might change depending on how the folks working on the citizen science IRB go. It might be project oriented, where there's all of the underlying projects under it. But what do either of you have thoughts on of the community, the biohacking citizen science community, DIY bio community, creating an IRB so that we as citizen scientists that don't have these PhDs and may not have labs and we're working from our garages and all these other things, we can now validate data. We can take it to the universities and have them also validate it. And we may be coming up with cures or workarounds that haven't been thought of or worked on before. But now we've got all this precedence and all of this data and modeling and research that we can take to them.
Sounds like it could be a good podcast topic.
Yes. Yeah, I think it is. I can tell you from personal experience, like I've had a hard time dealing with like universities and things like that. You know, if you go to a university and you ask them to, you know, say, hey, I got this intervention I want to try on an animal model. Can you do this for me? Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to ask you for like $30,000 or something like that, you know, and then only $10,000 of it is going to go into the project and the other 20 is going to go to the university or something like that. You know, it's like distributed stupid. And then, you know, then it's going to take a long time to get data back, and they're more concerned about the data than I don't know.
But also it's ownership, just, information ownership goes to them.
Yeah. So a lot of times it will. Like if you're making a donation to the university, yeah. Then I mean, a lot of times they have like, you know, they have their own IP rules and things like that. And like the stuff I've been doing is like I'm not concerned about IP at all, you know. I'm like trying to actually
open source it,
you know, make a difference, or like, you know, actually. And so like, you know, I've got like all these interventions I want to try, no access to fish, although I can make them from scratch, you know, if it gets to that. You know, there's private labs you can approach for animal model, like doing animal model stuff, but the costs are just astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you get into stuff like mice, you know, like I forget like the cost per day for mouse or something like that. It's like 95 cents a day per mouse. And, you know, just to have one engineered, you're looking at like $20,000 to $30,000.
Right. Because you can't only have an N of one. You have to have.
Right.
Right.
Yep. You have to keep a colony. Yeah. And so like, anyway, just so anyone who's doing any kind of animal tests will tell you like, you know, just plan on spending, you know, $80,000 to $400,000, mm-hmm. you know, on
just on the research side.
Yeah, just on the animal testing part.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So what's it sounds like you've got a long term goal, which is to come up with these interventions and test them out. Do you have a longer term plan for how to accomplish that?
Well, that's the thing is like, as a citizen science, like, I don't know, I basically told you what the hurdles are in, with the animal models and things like that, and financial restraints. But I think zebrafish still offer a citizen science, like a good opportunity, you know, if you're responsible with them and, you follow best practices and things like that. They're super cheap. You can get them at any pet store and modify them with CRISPR. And I think honestly, that's the only hope for the citizen scientist is the zebrafish.
The zebrafish.
So one of my favorite examples, I think I had this conversation with you at some point, actually both of you, but one of my favorite examples of a citizen science project that worked was a gentleman, I think he was either from Brazil or from Argentina, and he was a mechanic, a car mechanic. And someone bet him that he couldn't get the cork out of the wine bottle. And eventually he figured it out. And the mechanism that he ended up creating was bought by BD, Becton Dickinson. And it has helped a lot of women have babies without carrying over the infectious disease to this child. So there's a lot of responsibility that we as citizen scientists have, I think, to create things that maybe medical institutions haven't completely thought of or are working on, but maybe we've got other manners of working through them faster because we don't necessarily have those rules, laws, regulations to work through.
That's so true. And actually, the innovation that happens in the community is mind-blowing. I just see like DIY equipment and stuff all the time and workarounds that are just really impressive to me.
Right. And cost efficiency. So a lot of really beautiful ideas, cost efficiency. I think we as a community, if we're more vocal about them and have more buy-in from other people to say, we're creating a thing. We think it's going to be a really big deal. You should help us or at least pay attention to us so we can show it to you. I think that's going to be one of those relationships that we need to start bonding more.
Yeah, this has been an interesting conversation. And I hope we can all have more zebrafish in our future.
I hope so. I thought you had an aquarium.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Rich Lee.
Thanks, Rich Lee.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Join the community conversation and expand your gray matter on Twitter at @DC_BHV. And get transcripts, links, and show notes at whitehatslabcoats.org.